Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Episode 32 is about curious lunar swirls, laser retroreflectors, mineral detectors, and even earth science. Carly Pieters is Professor of Geological Science at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. The foci of study are the spectral areas of the Moon.
Now, with more than 4 billion years of history, the Moon's surface holds many secrets, not just Mare Highlands, which we have sampled during the Apollo, and we studied them through the Apollo samples for the last 50 years. But there are many things we don't know, and I'm going to highlight a few. These are things that we haven't sampled. The poles we've looked at remotely, we know there's hydrogen there. We suspect this is linked to ices. We know it's cold, it's very cold. I'm going to spend a little time, whatever time I have remaining, talking about swirls, Reiner-Gamma, and I'll tell you what that's about. But they're unusual albedo features that are neither craters or mixtures of unusual compositions. Then there's the irregular Mare patches. These are small features, no more than a kilometer or two in scale. They occur in volcanic terrain, and they clearly have a different texture that we've seen anywhere. And whether it's because they're very young or they're very old and are the last gasp of volcanism, we have no way of telling until we go there. And lastly, and this I can't speak of, we know from the remote measurements, there's a diversity of rock types across the Moon that have not yet been sampled and will tell us a lot more, will fill in some of the holes that we have in our current understanding. Okay. In the remaining few minutes, let me tell you a little bit about swirls. Reiner-Gamma is going to be a NASA CLIPS landing site planned in the next couple of years. It's a prominent magnetic anomaly in Oceania's focal arm on the near side. Now, there is no current magnetism on the Moon. There was a dynamo, and then with remote measurements, we've identified these areas that have magnetic anomalies that are very localized, constantly called magnetic anomalies. Reiner-Gamma, there is this group of cinder cones, essentially small volcanic terrain to the north. If you look at block populations from the Diviner, there's no signature. There's nothing to do with blocks there. Topography, you can't see Reiner-Gamma. There is no topographic relief that can be identified. Stepping back from that, you can see the craters over on the right is the beginning of some highland terrain. So Reiner-Gamma occurs right in the middle of this vast volcanic plains and is this highly unusual albedo feature. Okay, well, what is it? It's not because it's a different composition. We've tested that with several different of our remote sensing approaches. It's not freshly exposed material. So it's neither of the primary reasons that cause albedo differences on the Moon. It has no relationship to topography, but it does have a magnetic anomaly. It's associated with a mini magnetosphere associated with this particular feature. And you can see these beautiful wispy character. We'll look at one traverse from MQ through across the swirl. And this is the 40 kilometer swath width. And I can show you four different traverses. First, we'll look at some in the lower part of the image where it's general basaltic terrain. And then we'll compare that to the terrain that we see in the swirl itself. Okay, here we have a zero in on these two craters down in the south, which are typical basaltic terrain. And if you remember what things looked like when I showed you the Apollo 17 soil and crater, what we're seeing down here as we do a traverse across a crater, you go from a soil into a crater, which is the blue, and then back into the soil. Same thing is when we have the larger crater, which is older, but has developed material on the surface of the soil. You can start with the background soil. You go down a steep slope, which is freshly exposed material onto the floor, then back onto the local soil. So it's comparable to what we've seen in the laboratory with freshly exposed basalt compared to the well-developed regolith. Okay, soils are brighter at all wavelengths when we look at a traverse across soil. If you go from the swirl to the dark zone back to the swirl, you see the soil looks the same as what we saw elsewhere, but the character of the swirl itself is basically a brightening at all wavelengths, not just the visible. We believe this overall slope, red slope to the swirl material, is due to the nanophase iron that was mentioned earlier. It's a weathering product, but the character of why it is brighter than the surrounding soil is something that we haven't looked at extensively, but are looking at more recently, is if you go to the larger scale developed metallic iron, the micron size, which you can barely see, that those particles have no spectral effect except darkening. So the hypothesis is that these areas have the uppermost surface weathering product, but they don't have the developed micron size weathering products within the soil. And we want to know, are these properties comparable for everywhere else? And what we'll look at is images of the visible and images right in the middle of that pyroxene absorption. And you can still see the beautiful swirl, but what you see is also that the weathering product, namely the strength of the pyroxene absorption, now is affecting the character of the measured spectrum, and all the fresh craters are little black spots. One last thing is that these swirls, and this is the only time I'm going to mention water, David, I'm afraid. The swirls, especially in the Mare, are probably the driest areas on the moon. On the right is a measurement, an estimation of the very weak absorption due to OH at the longer wavelengths, and it essentially mirrors the character of the swirl itself. Okay, what are these? They're well-developed soils that have these nanophase irons on the grain, but there's two hypotheses of how they happen, which hopefully we'll be able to tell once we land and look at this. One is that it's produced by a fairy castle structure. The solar wind charged particles have electrostatic interactions with the soils, which create a very, very porous structure. If you remove the electrostatic, the charged particles, and compress that or collapse that, the soil becomes brighter. It doesn't have the dark structures that it can capture. The second hypothesis is that the reason that they're bright is that they don't have these micron size iron particles. Well, how can you get rid of them? Well, one is that because they're in this magnetically shielded area, that the development of these larger size iron particles require reduction by solar wind hydrogen. If you cut off the solar wind hydrogen, you don't produce the micron size iron. The second related hypothesis, though, is that, well, space weathering proceeded as normal. You produced everything, the micron size, the nanophase size, but because it's in a magnetic field and you do have gardening, every time a particle would be boosted up, it would be caught in the magnetic field and moved over. And gradually, over millions and millions of years, you'd remove these grains that have the micron-sized particles out. We don't know the answer to this. I leave this with you to show you that we don't know everything yet, but there are a lot of very physical properties of the surface of the moon that we really are eager to learn more of and hopefully will in the next few years.
Carle Pieters is not the only one interested in the moon's magnetic anomalies.
So, yeah, my name is Gail Iles. I'm a senior lecturer in physics at RMIT University. So my proposal is to send instrumentation to the specific locations of localized magnetic anomalies on the surface of the moon. We're protected on Earth by our magnetosphere, and that there's a complex interaction with the solar wind and the solar particles emitted by the sun. But we have this unique opportunity on the surface of the moon, which doesn't have its kind of a complete magnetic field, but instead has locations of very intense magnetic fields on a much smaller scale. And it would be fascinating to put some instrumentation at the site of these magnetic anomalies to investigate not just these small magnetospheres, but also the effects of space weathering on the surface of the moon, and in particular, behavior of the nanophase ion. So the work would address multiple Artemis science objectives, including understanding planetary processes and perhaps the impact history of the Earth-Moon system, because many of these magnetic anomalies are occurring at the site of impact craters. And it would address conducting experimental science in the lunar environment. So the four locations that I think are of particular interest are those with the highest magnetic field. So this map of the lunar surface has been obtained from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So that's in orbit around the moon. And the strength of the magnetic fields is actually at 30 kilometers altitude. So the Rainer Gamma Crater, Descartes, Ingenie, and Crisium Antipode have this 15 nanotesla strength magnetic field. But as I said, that's at 30 kilometers. So it would be much stronger on the surface. In particular, I think the Rainer Gamma Crater would be the most interesting of those four magnetic anomalies, mainly because it's also at the site of the most amount of iron. And my suspicion is that the nanophase iron through space weathering is actually being levitated within these small magnetic fields. So if we could get some scientific equipment into that location, I think that would be that would produce the maximum scientific return. So the criteria for the experiments would be that they must survive through the night. That would give a nice contrast between the positive and negative charging on the surface of the moon through the day-night cycle. There should be some radiation detectors, some particularly neutron spectrometers, perhaps some Mossbauer spectroscopy. And if it's possible to collect the iron, I think that would also be a good in situ resource utilization capability. And I'll end there.
The lunar swirls and magnetic anomalies have also caught the attention of David Blewett at the Applied Physics Laboratory, which is in Baltimore's Johns Hopkins University. Just a reminder that regolith is the fragmented rocky surface of the moon, and Diviner is an instrument on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been circling the moon since 2009.
I'm going to give a little review of why lunar swirls and magnetic anomalies are such great places to study processes related to regolith and dust. So yeah, there are two persistent mysteries, the lunar swirls and the magnetic anomalies. So to start off with the swirls, I'm going to take kind of a historical overview here. The thing we know today is Rainer Gamma was seen in early telescopes. And it was thought to be a crater, and it was actually given the name Galileus back in the mid or late 1600s. The tail up to the northeast doesn't look like a normal crater ray, and people realize that it doesn't cast a shadow, so it's not a highland ridge. And, you know, over the years, ground-based telescopic images improved and revealed it to be an albedo marking, which we now call Reiner Gamma. It was clear that Reiner Gamma is something funny. Then came the space age, and we found out that there are swirls on the far side. And in addition, we found out that there could be complicated sinuous swirls that are purely confined to the highland, as you see the swirls near Firsov. Then, of course, the really big discovery from the Apollo era came from the subsatellite magnetometers. And they revealed that while the moon doesn't have a global dynamo field, there are areas of magnetized crustal rocks called magnetic anomalies, and that Reiner Gamma happens to correspond to one of these. And this is where we get into this question of why there's two persistent mysteries. So one is, you know, what's the origin of the magnetized crust? And I'm not going to get into that here today. And then there's the completely separate question of what is the origin of the swirls? And as a corollary, how are they related to the magnetic anomalies? So let's look at those hypotheses for the origin of the swirls. So the major categories that have been proposed are shown there. The first is solar wind standoff. And the idea here is that the presence of the magnetic field attenuates the solar wind flux that reaches the surface in normal non-magnetic areas, and that this slows down the normal space weathering, soil darkening process that comes about through sputtering and implantation. And there are a set of ideas related to comets. The first was from Pete Schultz, and that idea is that gas and dust in the coma of a comet modifies the surface. And he has looked at that more closely in more recent years in his work with Megan Brooks-Seal. And then there are the alternate sort of variants on that from Patrick Pinay and Larissa Starakina about nucleus fragments or meteoroid swarms that actually scour or plow the surface and expose fresh material. Then the most recent ideas have to do with unusual dust effects. And we have this concept from Ian Garrick Bethel where the interaction of the solar wind with a magnetic field sets up electric fields. And these influence the motions of electrostatically lofted dust, causing it to be attracted to or repelled from certain locations, and therefore accumulations of bright, fine dust particles. That's what the bright swirls are. And Carly Peters posited that, well, maybe these unusual skipping back and forth of these dust grains modifies the uppermost texture of the surface, perhaps destroying the so-called fairy castle structure that's present in normal areas, thereby modifying the photometric properties and giving you the bright swirl that we see. And Carly has also suggested that there could be some kind of magnetic sorting taking place based on essentially the maturity of these dust grains, their nanophase iron content, due to the actual magnetic field sorting things out. Right, so all these hypotheses for swirl formation are related to regolith and dust processes, right? Space weathering, you know, the relative roles of the micrometeoroids and solar wind. Now, certainly, you know, comet parts must strike the moon, whether it's more recently, as in the Schultz hypothesis, or certainly over lunar geologic history. Well, we certainly know that landing rocket exhaust can modify the photometric properties of the surface. Now, while deep accumulations of dust appear to be ruled out by the thermal inertia measurements from Deviner, there could be thin accumulations of some kind. And, you know, we know that there's evidence for low altitude motions, the Surveyor Hot Horizon Glow, dust detector experiments, and so forth. So I would say that the top questions related to dust and regolith at the magnetic anomalies are, the first one there is the opportunity to separate the micrometeoroid bombardment from solar wind exposure in space weathering. And, you know, then what does that tell us about space weathering on other airless bodies? Second, has the lunar surface been modified by the action of gas, dust, or other comet-related effects? And third, magnetic anomalies are predicted to have especially active dust environments. So can we observe such activity in situ? And what can these processes that are at work there tell us about what happens at other places on the moon or even on other airless bodies? And so that the answers to all those questions, you know, we need to have measurements on the surface within magnetic anomaly. And a static lander mission is a great start. But really, in order to take full advantage of the science potential of these unique natural laboratories, a long-range rover is needed. Thanks for listening.
Retro reflectors are very common on Earth. You will quite likely have some on the tail of your car or bicycle, encased in red plastic. You see them as cat's eyes on the road, or as roadside markers that reflect the light from your car's headlights back into your eyes. They consist of a set of three mirrors mounted at 90 degrees to each other that reflect light back to where it came from, that is, the retro part. Retro reflectors were placed on the moon by several Apollo astronauts and robotically by two Soviet lunar cod rovers. Ever since, lasers are shone from Earth onto them and the reflected photons are collected in a telescope. Timing the interval from sending a laser pulse to its receipt can reveal much, including the precise distance to the moon. All of the existing lunar retroreflectors are in equatorial regions. In May of 2020, this argument was put forward for retroreflectors to be placed at the lunar south pole.
Good afternoon all. I'm Vishnu and our team is based at NASA Goddard. Today I'm going to talk about the importance of placing new retroreflectors. A short background on lunar retroreflectors. These are optical devices that require no power. They reflect light in the same direction as the incident light. We have five retroreflectors placed on the near side of the moon from the Apollo and the Lunar Code missions. They continue to be functional and allow near millimeter level two-way range measurements from Earth-based laser stations. These retroreflectors have stood the test of time and the data retrieved from them continue to impact multidisciplinary science. Some technicalities, heat becomes an issue at the lunar surface. During sunlit conditions, reflectors get heated up and this distorts their desired optical properties. So you want the corner cubes to be small to avoid thermal gradients, but large to help gain signal strength. The Apollo era solution was to use a large arrays with multiple small cubes. Despite this, sunlit conditions stack up a non-uniform distribution of the LLR data with lunar phase. This would introduce some systematics in the model fits. Yet another problem is that the nodding motion of the moon, also called librations, changes the optimal tilt of the array and thus reduces the range accuracy. This design has been improved over the years, and new generation of reflectors use a single large corner cube design, such as the one funded by Eclipse and led by University of Maryland. Since we're going to the lunar south pole, a simple idea to overcome this thermal design limitation is to place a reflector in one of the cooler regions available at the lunar south pole. The plot on the right looks at the lunar south pole. Colored areas on it give both sufficient Earth visibility as well as low thermal variations. We heard several talks today and yesterday about various mission concepts that aim to explore the PSRs. These reflectors would be easily deployed during such an expedition by rovers or astronauts. Simulations show that a reflector at the lunar south pole would help strengthen detection of the CMB equatorial shape. It will also reduce the observation time required for its recovery by almost a decade with the existing. The presence of an equatorial shape of the CMB would modify resonant modes of the lunar core. Resolving this shape would also help us to evaluate the relaxed state or stresses at the depth of the lunar core. Since it's possible to lift the thermally motivated size constraint of the reflectors, larger reflectors can now be considered for deployment at the lunar south pole. They will dramatically help in increasing the strength of the return signal, thereby allowing participation to lunar laser ranging efforts from the wider satellite laser ranging community. Note that currently only 4 active stations provide LLR data, limited to a narrow band of north latitude. The data offers sensitivity for estimation of Earth orientation parameters, among others. Okay, so to summarize, retroreflectors are valuable scientific assets on the moon and have demonstrated longevity that spanned over several decades. As we saw, a new reflector placed at the cold region near the lunar south pole would have a significant impact on multidisciplinary science derived from LLR data analysis. Retroreflectors are deploy and forget. So once placed, the rest is taken care of by either dedicated observers, analysis groups on Earth, or orbiting LIDAR spacecrafts. Retroreflectors also contribute towards realizing long-term goals of establishing a lunar geophysical network.
In November of 2021, Vishnu was still setting out his case from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland.
Our poster builds the case for why it's very desirable to have a lunar laser ranging retroreflector situated very close to the south pole of the moon. So surface retroreflectors are currently on the moon that have enabled like long-term geodetic monitoring capabilities, and they continue to be a priority for future lunar missions. What makes the South Pole special for laser ranging is that it will provide the largest north-south separation to help understand both latitudinal librations and subtle signatures on rotation from the lunar interior. Now, second, a larger reflector will massively improve the signal return, but the thermal environment places a very strong limitation on its size, which can be bypassed if it's placed in a cold region providing sufficient Earth visibility. That's what you see here, with the potential to also bring in more participating stations from global Earth stations. Now, carrying a LIDAR on board would further enhance the science capabilities, not only from it would help create a high-resolution spectral map of the PSRs, but enable monitoring of temporal variability of dust from surface operations of frost formation to the level of few tens of nanometer.
Also at the Goddard Space Flight Center is Dina Bauer. Her interests are different. In July of 2020, she was advocating for an instrument to identify minerals and water on the moon. She calls it CLUME, the Compact Lunar Hydration and Mineralogy Imager.
So just a quick instrument summary. It's a small size, weight, and power instrument. It's designed to identify and characterize water ice, hydrates, and hydroxyl minerals as well, and as well as other minerals and compounds that are of interest for in-situ resource utilization. It utilizes a 1 megapixel SLS detector coupled with an LVF. So there are a couple of filter options that we are designing this with. So hyperspectral imaging or a combination of the two, hyperspectral and multispectral imaging. And the great thing is it's a compact and adaptable instrument enough that it could be applicable to different platforms. So the science that we can achieve, so basically we're looking at midwave IR through longwave IR, so that includes 2 to 12 microns, which covers a wide range of compounds, minerals, as I mentioned, and this includes being able to distinguish between, for example, OH that you would find in ice versus like OH hydrates, which is very important, obviously, to distinguish those. So basically, this is if an astronaut were to deploy this. And so if you could deploy this on a tripod, it could certainly be deployed on a rover in a similar fashion. Each frame is actually saved on the instrument and then can be analyzed at the base station or for Earth-based telemetry. And then it does have a reference spectrum library set up so that the instrument will flag specific target compounds and alert the astronaut.
Another proposed instrument would search for lipid biomarkers in the lunar regolith.
So hi, I'm Mary Beth Wilhelm. I'm here at NASA Ames Research Center, and I wanted to tell you guys about an instrument that we are developing to look for organics in icy regolith. This is a sample preparation instrument that integrates and automates more traditional laboratory techniques and can optimally analyze organics that might be trapped on the moon. So our motivation is to develop key enabling technologies for astrobiology And our specific target organic is lipids. And there's a few reasons for this. Lipids are ubiquitous in abiotic organic matter, such as in meteorites, and also comprises the cellular membranes of life as we know it. Lipids also contain diagnostic information in their structures and within patterns within certain classes of lipids. And so when you look at and analyze lipid structures, you can learn about how that molecule was synthesized. They're also incredibly stable within the geologic record. And I think this is a really important point, as their longevity is equivalent to the age of the solid surfaces in the solar system that we're interested in studying. So when you look back in the rock record on Earth, some of the oldest molecular evidence of life that we have are preserved lipid structures, and they can last over a billion years, which is about an order of magnitude longer than other types of organics. So I think these are really important molecules to target in the solar system. So there are some very efficient laboratory types of lipid extraction techniques that have been used for over 70 years. And these are incredibly efficient. They overcome a lot of common challenges associated with analysis of natural samples, such as low concentration of organics, or encapsulation or interaction of those organics with the minerals. And so that's why they're so widespread in labs. But you know, obviously, these are laboratory processes and human operator dependent. In terms of the current flight extraction techniques for lipids, there is the SAM instrument on Mars Science Laboratory, which is operationally more simple than what we're developing, but uses thermal extraction to access the organics. And that high temperature used to liberate the organics can be destructive to the origin diagnostic structures that we're really interested in analyzing. So this is sort of the motivation for building Excalibur. So ultimately, we'd like to use the sort of instrumentation to analyze a volatile-rich regolith on the moon. And this is something that could be used in situ or deployed by a crewed mission or even for a returned sample to characterize that organic content. So it's believed that there may be a repository of the organics that were potentially available on early Earth that were delivered during the late heavy bombardment in topographically low regions at the lunar poles. And there's been a few recent studies suggesting that the rapid burial by ejecta during the late heavy bombardment and subsequent lava flows could have preserved those organics since their deposition or synthesis. And they were also protected from radiation and sustained in these incredibly cold temperatures. So that would enhance long-term preservation. It's also worth noting that although there were no organics identified in samples returned from the Apollo missions, that LCROSS did find evidence for organic building blocks and lunar ejecta plume. So I think that, you know, this is a really compelling target and could also serve as an abiotic control for future life detection missions. So it would improve our understanding of the lipid distribution in a non-biological planetary environment where you don't have issues with terrestrial contamination, such as with meteorites that we study here on Earth.
When the first Artemis astronauts land on the moon, they will have less mobility than the Apollo 15, 16, and 17 crews did. Lindsay Atkinson at NASA's EVA program executive explained why in May of 2020.
Our estimates are that per EVA, so an EVA being two crew members together for up to 6 hours in duration, that per each of those EVA events, the cumulative distance traversed without a rover is about 16 kilometers per EVA.
Most attention during the Artemis missions will be on the moon. However, just as the Apollo 16 crew photographed the Earth with an ultraviolet camera, Earth science can be done from the lunar surface. NASA HQ senior exploration scientist Ben Bussey explains.
I think Earth science, when I discussed the six themes that we're currently using to try and blanket the science that you can do, a platform to observe the universe that was meant to, and perhaps we need to explicitly have a bullet there. The idea of science that you can do, Earth science that you can do from the lunar surface would fit under that theme. And I know there are many Earth scientists who have ideas for small telescopes. There are things you can do at the moon to study the Earth that you can't do in high Earth orbit. You want to study the full disk Earth over a range of phases. etc. And so, yes, earth science is very much open to try and use the moon opportunistically to do earth science from its surface.